This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're tuned in to Sunday Arts Magazine, live from Queer Stories from the NGV Collection at the National Gallery of Victoria. Proudly brought to you by Joy Partners, the NGV.
You're here on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, live at the NGV. And that was Kylie with Come Into My World.
Oh, I think I've heard of her.
Have you heard of Kylie? I think you know.
Hey, we've heard. Somebody told us that Miles has a doggy
that's called Kylie.
Sorry, Miles.
He's so gay.
I don't know about that. Now, we are still talking to Dr. Angela Hessen here on Joy. Now, Angela, you've looked after one part of the well, you looked after the whole thing, but just tell us a little bit about the structure of the exhibition.
Sure. So with the structure of the exhibition, we wanted to be very clear that we weren't providing an encyclopedic history of queer art and culture. We didn't want to be providing a kind of guidebook. For one thing, that could have a certain kind of anthropological detached quality, which was really the opposite of what we wanted. And also, as we've said before, there are gaps and omissions in the NGV's collection, which I think would complicate that kind of structure. So what we've done is something that is thematic, rather than historical or geographical. And we've looked at all different categories that can be applied across different historical periods of queer art and culture. So there are wonderful opportunities to look at relationships between works that might be one from, you know, 2nd century BC and one that's present day. And it gives us a way to reflect on the way that queerness has changed, the ways that, you know, the things that have remained constant. And it avoids that issue of too much labelling, which I think, as Ted has said before, you know, there's been far too much labelling.
And that leads me to the follow-up question to that one, Angela, is when you have 5 curators in a room, how do you narrow down the themes, basically, that you've used?
It actually happened quite naturally, I think, because we were telling these stories through works in the collection. And in a way, it was a blessing that we did have a finite collection to work with. So we were discovering works that we had never seen before, but in many cases, the works just fell naturally into these themes. And we should also add that many of the works could have been included in numerous different sections. You know, some of the works that are in queer royalty could just as easily have sat in camp, for example. But I think we had remarkably few disagreements. It was just a really kind of beautiful process.
Although if Ted was involved, I reckon there'd be lots of arguments. No, Ted, joking. Hey, so what we're talking about, your section, the first word is camp. Mm-hmm. Now, we were discussing it off air about camp meaning so many different things in other parts of the world, like when you lived in London.
Yes, it was an interesting one, I think, when you mentioned that you associated camp mostly with gay men. And I think that is the way of it in Australia very much. I grew up in the UK, and I think there is an association of camp with gay men in the UK, and I think probably throughout much of the world. But I think in England, there is a broader association that links to things like, for example, the pantomime tradition, which is, you know, very kitschy, very much about excess and about surfaces, sometimes about quite bawdy humour. And it's about playing with all kinds of hierarchies. So not just those that relate to gender and sexuality, but also things like class and taste. And for me, that's very much what camp is about, is that really subversive quality.
I also think it's a little bit generational as well, because I think people of different ages and different groups think of camp a bit differently. But you also just mentioned the word kitsch. Yeah. And I think we were talking about that as well. That also has a fairly broad sort of definition, and you sort of roll that into the one, well, similar themes, aren't they, as well?
Yeah, very much so. And I think this is the terrific thing about camp and kitsch, is they're both very kind of elusive, slippery sensibilities or categories.
And a bit of fun.
So much fun. And very subjective. You know, I think we all, you know, and this is the thing, taste is such a subjective category, isn't it? Yes. There's no such thing as inherently good taste and likewise bad taste. And this is where camp and
David knows all about that.
There's so much scope to play with those ideas, you know.
All right. Well, tell us, what is camp in your section of this exhibition?
Well, I should also just clarify that we all have worked across all sections of the exhibition. So I think it's a joy for me to speak about this, but we've all kind of contributed to it very much. But for me, I mean, I think there is no tidy definition of camp. And this is something which Susan Sontag wrote about in her groundbreaking notes on camp in the 1960s. She wrote that to talk about camp is to betray it. And what she was alluding to there is the idea of camp as a kind of secret language. Yeah. So one which is legible to people in the know, and very often that means queer communities, but perhaps more opaque to conservative forces within society that might be hostile to those kinds of sensibilities. But I think camp is very much often about an emphasis on the surface. It's about playing with ideas of triviality and depth. For example, within art, you know, we think that there's often a kind of binary setup between content and surface decoration, frivolity versus depth. Camp really undermines those ideas so beautifully. It makes the ridiculous serious. You know, there's often a very strong kind of political point beneath the surface of frivolity or decoration. And I think this is the idea, really, is that it communicates things to a knowing audience, ideas about taste and subversion and hierarchy that more traditionally elevated art forms, that high art can't necessarily communicate.
Give us a couple of the examples of what you call camp in this exhibition.
So I think one of the really lovely things about it is it has a really long history, and you are actually wearing a lapel badge a pretty fabulous lapel badge.
And it is so camp, isn't it?
I think one of the campest objects in the exhibition, and this is I will describe it for you because obviously not everybody can see it. This is a lapel badge that's featuring an object in the exhibition, which is a porcelain teapot, which dates to 1884. And the teapot takes the form of the figure of a dandy. And certainly on the front...
Now, what's a dandy, for those that might not know?
So a dandy is a figure who emerged in the late 18th century and really kind of came to prominence in the 19th century. And a dandy is a very fashionable man, essentially. He is a man of taste and discernment, who is interested in his personal presentation, very interested in the decoration of his home often, a participator in cultural events.
He's so gay.
Well, this is the interesting thing. Later on, definitely, and once we get to the time of Oscar Wilde, who's really an archetypal dandy, very much so. But the really interesting thing is that in the 18th and early 19th centuries, there are all kinds of accounts of women swooning over dandies. And that's a really queer thing too, in a way, because if we think about ideas of what gender meant in those periods, masculinity is so much about being stoical and upright.
Do you think being comfortable, though, around that sort of man, that women would just feel comfortable and wanted to hang out?
I think so, and I think there was something very alluring in a more expansive idea of gender, you know, gender that wasn't, you know, masculinity that wasn't just about being stoical and staid and upright.
And going back to this porcelain teapot, it's a mirror behind it. Why is there a mirror behind it?
So the mirror behind it is to show the other side of the object, and the other side shows an aesthetic woman. So 1880s, this is the period of the aesthetic movement. Oscar Wilde is writing a lot about art and decoration. Everyone's fascinated by ideas of taste and discernment. And this object has a male and female aesthete sharing one porcelain body. So within that, there's a way in which it actually encapsulates or embodies that period's interest in gender fluidity too. And there's an inscription on the base of the teapot, which you can't actually see when it's exhibited, but we do talk about it in the label. And the inscription reads, "Fearful consequences through the laws of natural selection and evolution of living up to one's teapot."
Well, it goes with that.
That is brilliant.
It's pretty fantastic. And I think, I mean, what this, it alludes to many different things. In part, it's a direct reference to Oscar Wilde's time at Oxford. And this is when he began to be known not just as a great poet and writer and a wit and a raconteur, but also as an authority on art and taste. And one of his best-known aphorisms that was quoted from this time was, "I find it harder and harder each day to live up to my blue china." And so what this object is doing is parodying that notion. This is the absurd consequence of living up to your china as you become the teapot that you've admired too much. But it also relates to the context, of course, of this is coming after Darwin's publication of Origin of Species. And the reference in the inscription to laws of natural selection and evolution relates to those controversies and anxieties that Darwin's theories had fueled about the malleability of human existence, human identity, and the idea that, you know, everything, including gender and sexuality, might not be fixed.
Yeah, and also the fact that soon after that, when Oscar Wilde was sent to prison and then luckily escaped to France, is that that whole movement started to disappear because it was looked frowned upon.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I might get caught, so I better not do that.
Absolutely. There was an enormous period of anxiety and quite reasonable anxiety in the wake of Wilde's trial. And then, of course, when we get into the First World War and there is the emergence of something that's known as muscular Christianity, which is seen as the kind of the antidote to Wildean aestheticism and ideas of, for example, effeminacy as something that is seen as incredibly dangerous for national character. So there is a huge backlash against dandyism that happens around that time.
All right, give us another example of something in the collection.
that embodies those ideas of camp and kitsch. Well, interestingly, around about the same time, and this plays to our ideas on camp and gender, I think, quite interestingly, there's a beautiful Art Nouveau poster for a play featuring Sarah Bernhardt.
Yes.
And this is an advertisement for the play Mélisande and Pelléas, which was a symbolist romance by Maurice Maeterlinck. And Bernhardt was an absolutely remarkable figure and one who I think has such an important place in queer history.
Unbelievable. Just the strong images of her alone, let alone her performances.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so interesting that you mention those because she orchestrated those.
She was
a master in the art of self-promotion. And she really mobilized mass media as they started to emerge in the 19th century. She was extremely successful as a business person. So she actually funded the first production of Oscar Wilde's Salome in 1894. You know, absolutely groundbreaking. And she starred in it herself. And she also knew how to capitalize on scandal. So Bernhardt's bisexuality was something that she really promoted that herself. And one of her first lovers was the great artist Louise Abema. And Bernhardt had herself photographed in a coffin, which she apparently slept in.
She did.
Proto-goth. Yes. And with a bust of Abema sort of leaning over the coffin in a slightly sinister way. And, you know, far from, it's very interesting in the context we talk about all of the anxieties around persecution around this time. Bernhardt really mobilized them and used them to her own advantage. And this, the poster is so interesting because it shows Bernhardt playing the female lead in Mélisande and Pelléas. And this was in 1901. But one of the other things that Bernhardt was particularly famous for was for playing male characters. Mm. And 3 years later, she'd apparently exhausted the possibilities of Mélisande, so she invited her friend, the actor Mrs. Patrick Campbell, to come and play Mélisande, and she played opposite Mrs. Patrick Campbell as the male Pelléas.
Wow.
So, you know, thinking about definitions of camp, you know, that original definition comes from the French word compé, which is to perform or to play. And this is what Bernhardt did too. And the poster itself is so decorative. Art Nouveau is something that I think is, you know, often been associated with kitsch and camp.
So talking about decorative, you know, like, that can mean so much, can't it? And this exhibition has so much in that world.
It does, absolutely. And I think It's very interesting because decoration is something that has been gendered so much yes. throughout history too. We think about even that term decorative arts implies to some extent that they are less serious, that there is less meaning encompassed.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think okay. it's, you know, the fact that fine and decorative art, high art and decorative art, these are presented as binaries. And very often decoration has been feminized within that. I mean, the fact that even so much of the work that was produced by women throughout history wasn't even given the artist's name with it. You know, we have so many works with artist or maker unknown that are from our decorative arts collections.
And women weren't allowed to get involved did it secretly.
No, and then if you kind of extend that idea, you think that for men to produce highly decorative works was in some ways, you know, seen as problematic within the gender politics of many of the historical periods that we're looking at. And there is something almost inherently queer in men producing highly decorative works.
Can you pigeonhole something for us that you would like to talk about in that what realm?
Well, I mean, I think going back to the ideas of camp and kitsch, a really wonderful, more recent example...
I'm happy to talk about that.
Yeah.
You can tell, guys, David loves this subject.
I'm big on kitsch.
I think, I mean, the artist Peter Tully is a wonderful, more recent example of somebody who really played with the possibilities of decorative art and the kind of hierarchies that have been constructed around it. And Peter Tully did the most wonderful work. He is, as I think many of us will know, an Australian artist and designer. He was the wonderful artist David McDiarmid's lover for a number of years, and they remained incredibly close friends for the rest of Tully's life. And Tully produces the most magnificent range of decorative objects, jewellery. We have a fantastic example, rare example of his furniture in this exhibition. And even the materials that Tully chose to work with, he chose to work very often with plastics. You know, these are the opposite of precious materials.
And when was this?
So this is from the 1970s.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
When plastic was coming into play in furniture.
It's plastic is, you know, it's widely available and it's a cheap material. So if you think about what you would usually see as being presented as high art, plastic wouldn't be high on that list. But there's a way in which Tully really elevated these everyday, ordinary materials and images to the realm of high art. And he communicated some very kind of political messages in these very, very playful, disposable mediums.
And it's quite colourful as well.
Very colourful, very colourful. And he plays with all kinds of quite hallowed ideas. You know, there's references to Catholic iconography in there. There's a wonderful necklace which has Elvis's portrait. And, you know, you think of that idea of Elvis fandom as being so inherently kitschy too. And there's a way in which I think he brings all these references together in a way that is at one time playful and kitschy and silly, but also quite reverent and quite loving. He creates, they're not absurd objects. They are still very kind of beautiful objects. Mm.
That's the sort of the theme that I'm getting, I suppose, from what you're saying, Angela, is that some of these things are frivolous and absurd to a certain point, but there is some undertone and, you know, some sort of meaning underneath it. And that seems to be the general sort of message, I suppose, in regards to camp and kitsch that I'm getting.
I think it's all about asking us to question the kind of hierarchies that determine social positioning. So whether those relate to gender and sexuality or whether they relate to class or taste or what is high art and what is kitsch. You know, I think they draw attention to those kinds of hierarchies and they make them absurd in a way. And I think that's a really useful thing for art to do.
And also the fact is that what was big in the 70s is big again now. You know, like so much of the jewellery that you're seeing now is absolutely outrageous again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, I mean, this is interesting too when we've been looking at relationships between works that are going back, you know, to 6 centuries BCE to today, we see this wonderful kind of cyclical nature of taste. Yep. You see the same objects and images kind of re-emerging in different forms.
Yeah, and the fact is that something that was around 1,000 years ago, we still look on it and go, wow, there's so much beauty there. Yeah. And craftsmanship as well, that artists were, what they were doing back then, you know, was just astounding.
Absolutely. And I think it's an interesting assumption that we can make, particularly when we're thinking about art and queer culture, is that there has been a kind of a linear trajectory of improvement, in a way, that from darker periods of conservatism and lesser expression to greater possibility and greater acceptance. And I think that's one of the things that this exhibition has really revealed, is it's not the case at all. Mm. The history of queer art is very meandering. Classical period sees far greater acceptance and normalization.
Well, Michelangelo, for instance, you know, like the Statue of David, which is a great piece of art, but you look at it in a different light now, where because of this exhibition, there was an article in the Age newspaper about a month ago talking about, like his love of men, but always had women friends, but his love of men. Which would have been quite shocking back then.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and Michelangelo has a really long history of being queered, and indeed, even something, the story of David and Goliath, Michelangelo's most famous work, there are many versions of that which have really strong homoerotic resonance. And I think, looking all the way, if we look back to the classical period, we think all of the kind of categories and interdictions that came in with the early Christian fathers didn't exist then. Pansexuality was the default, Yep. And there's ways in which I think we could kind of learn from that history.
And the ancient Greeks, of course, were openly either went with a man or a woman, and it was totally accepted. And then we've gone so bland in a recent time. But not here at the NGV, because the queer exhibition is breaking down all those barriers, which, Joe, Angela, it's just, and I mentioned about going up, seeing the exhibition when you were on together with Miles, but, the fact is that you're opening that door for older people that go, well, I've struggled all my life as a queer person, and now it's so open. And then for the young people to, come screaming through the door as they are right now, where they don't have a worry in the world.
It's interesting. And this has changed so much even in my lifetime. I mean, I think about when I was kind of, coming of age in the early 90s, and it was a completely different climate to what we see now. And that's something that's one of the most exciting things to see. And, Miles and I were talking before about walking through the space and seeing lots of young people who are obviously on dates up there. And it's absolutely beautiful. All picking up. Look, I hope so. We've said if this is the one legacy of this exhibition, we've been the five queer Cupids. I think it's something that's really, really exciting to see. And even with my relatively limited experience of my lifespan, I've seen that change so enormously. I think even since we began working on this show, even since 2017, there's been a really marked shift.
There has been, and it started with marriage equality, and how that really turned a lot of people's thoughts and changed a lot of people's minds. It was a hurtful time as well, but it was also a time when the average person that might not have a queer child, but is now looking at it in a very different way.
I think an incredibly difficult time, but I think one of the things that has happened since that moment is that casual homophobia has become far less socially acceptable. I mean, I think that's something that I've noticed. I mean, even I think for people who in the past might have felt empowered to express those kinds of opinions, the fact mainstream acceptance does something, I think, for it to suppress that kind of impulse.
Angela, thank you so much for chatting with us today, and thank you for your commitment to this exhibition over the last 5 years. Did you get at any stage you thought, I'm over it, I want to move on?
No, never for a second. And in fact, to be honest, I think we're all quite sad that we're not.
Volume two.
Well, this is the thing. We thought too queer.
Too queer. Hey,
and we're still finding things that we wish we could have included.
Too queer in 5 years' time. How's that? start working on it.
Yeah.
Okay. But, thank you.
But sorry, Angela, just going back to the... I think when you were talking to you and Miles earlier, you talked about this came out of the marriage equality sort of debate and everything else. How have you found this whole process, I suppose, putting it all together at this stage? You know, have you, has that been a little bit of a, you know, a healing or therapeutic sort of process for you as well?
It's been a really beautiful process. It's been, and it's been very different to your usual curatorial process, I think, because usually, you know, we all become invested in any project that we're working on, but this is much more personal. And I think it has actually been, I mean, one of the things that's been really wonderful is realizing how much of this history exists in the collection that we didn't know was there. Yeah. And that's such a powerful discovery, because we think for all that, you know, for much of the period that we are looking at, the NGV had very conservative acquisition policies, and yet all of these wonderful stories are still here. They slipped into the collection anyway, you know, and we have the capacity to tell this incredibly rich, beautiful history for everybody. We didn't know we had that, and I think that has just been an amazing thing to be a part of.
Okay, that's great. All right, we've been talking to Dr. Angela Hessen here on Joy 94.9, Sunday Arts Magazine, live from the NGV.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.